today we're here with Professor Gregory LeBlanc. He's a professor at UC Berkeley of Finance and Strategy. Hi, Professor. Welcome to the Crypto Rabbit Hole.
Thanks for having me, Alex.
Just to start off, generally, I've found it in the past to be difficult to learn about money and how to think about investing as a younger person and so on. So my first question is, like, in your opinion, do you think kids are being prepared enough at a young enough age to learn about financial literacy?
Yeah, absolutely not, right? You know, and I think it's a bit different. You know, when I was younger, I don't think very many people invested in stocks. You know, I was given some equities and some debt at a very young age, right, from my parents and grandparents. And so I was aware of it and kind of followed it and so forth. But I also think that, you know, at my age, you know, we had to kind of, I hate to sound like an old person, right, but, you know, we had to kind of earn money, you know, as kids, because we didn't study as much. And so we had to go and, you know, make money. And so just kind of managing money was something that was, even if people didn't understand financial markets, they kind of understood, like, okay, you got to earn, got to save, that kind of thing. I find a lot of my students come to college without having, you know, earned very much money, without having to manage any money, and often with, you know, little or no experience in financial markets. So I actually think that, you know, the earlier you can, you know, start thinking about money, investing it, earning it, spending it, managing it, you know, the better, so that you're not caught off guard when you get thrust into, you know, a life of earning and investing.
Since in recent years, the market's kind of been steadily rising and there hasn't been too much turmoil. Like, how would you instruct younger investors to prepare for this kind of volatility that we're seeing a lot today?
Well, I mean, keep in mind that probably the best returning investment that you can make when you're young is through education. Right. You know, if you had to choose between investing in the stock market, investing in, say, university education, you know, you should definitely pick the university education over investing in the stock market. And so, you know, investing at that age typically is something you do purely, you know, as a learning experience. Mm-hmm. Right. And it's not really, you're not planning to retire on the money that you set aside as a teenager. Right. Yeah, totally. But that said, you know, when you start to earn money and start to invest it, you can't rely on the markets always going up, but you also know that, you know, you've got 20, 30, 40 years, you've got a lot of ups and downs. And we one thing we know with the great, we're pretty confident in, is that over the long haul, you know, you're going to do fine. You know, you'll make a lot of money. If you set aside your money and you invest it, particularly if you invest it in equities, invest it in stocks, you know, it will grow. We're pretty confident in that.
Would you say that's your main word of advice to your students?
Well, so I think that a lot of people think that, you know, financial management is all about, you know, your portfolio that you have in your brokerage account and so forth. But we make all sorts of decisions in our everyday life, right? In terms of, you know, how we spend our money, right? And right. And oftentimes we do silly things when we spend our money, right? We, you know, we pay more for things than we have to, or we get paid less than we could potentially. So I think of financial literacy and wisdom as including far more than just kind of your you know, liquid assets, right? So, you know, even decisions about whether to buy a house or to buy a car, mm-hmm. right? Or how to pay for your education, you know, or, you know, how to use things like credit cards. You know, if you have, for instance, credit card debt that's racking up 18%, and then you have money in the stock market that's, you know, even if it's making 15%, you know, you're on the losing side of that deal. So, you know, no matter how much money you've got in the stock market, if you're sitting on, say, credit card debt, you know, you're screwed. So I think you have to have a very holistic view of how you invest. And for that, you know, learning finance as early as possible is important. I always wish that we, you know, taught people finance in high school. Some people do, right? There are some high schools where you can learn it. But oftentimes they're very superficial. You know, you learn some basic stuff about balancing your checkbook or whatever, but, you know, the strategy for squeezing the most juice out of the lemon and making sure that you're in a good spot financially, not just, you know, 50 years from now, but like next week. That's stuff that I think is practical skill everybody should learn.
Quickly, do you think there's a reason for that? Like a reason that schools don't teach that?
You know, I don't know, because they teach stuff like trigonometry. I mean, what the right. hell is that? Like whoever, I mean, look, who uses trigonometry? Like nobody. This is a complete and total waste of time. And I think they just teach it because that's kind of what they learned. And so they feel like, you know, you got to have a job for this. I think it's kind of crazy, the stuff that people learn. It's oftentimes very academical. And, you know, even in math, I'd learn statistics before I'd learn calculus. But for some reason, they don't, you know, teach statistics in a lot of schools. So, you know, I think there are a lot of things that they assume parents are going to teach their kids, or that right. they're going to learn somehow on their own. And it's just not true. I mean, most parents don't know how to manage money and invest yeah. money. And if they did, they're probably too busy to teach it. So, you know, I think schools really could play a huge role here. And even if it's not formal education, you know, why is it that we have like a football team and we don't have like an investing team? Right. You know, like after school, why don't you sit around and, you know, pick stocks and, you know, stuff like that.
Yeah, I totally agree. I think it's a huge problem that, you know, they really don't prepare us fully for the real world. Shifting a little bit into, you know, like current trends and everything. Do you have an opinion on these, you know, Reddit and Robinhood type phenomenon where, you know, stocks are being driven based on hype and like internet trends? And also, do you see something like crypto actually falling into that rather as a rather than like a strong asset?
Yeah, I mean, look, my view is that this is kind of like the crack cocaine of investing. You know, Robinhood is, and I remember when Robinhood was founded, I think it's fantastic business idea, business model. But I also think, you know, casinos are fantastic business models. And,
right.
you know, so, you know, Reddit and, you know, Wall Street Bets and, you know, Twitter is also a good source of lots of yeah. information. I wouldn't call it information, but lots of discussions about, you know, different things happening in financial markets. I think they're very dangerous. You know, I know a lot of people who are saying, oh, I got to invest in this or that company because, you know, I read this on Reddit or whatever. It's like, yeah, but, you know, what'd you read on Bloomberg? You know, what'd you read in right. Financial Times? What'd you read in the Wall Street Journal? Like, what'd you read in Barron's, right? You know, what's in The Economist? So I feel like, you know, if you really want to be educated about financial markets, you know, most people are reading the wrong stuff. Like they're reading the stuff because of its delivery method as opposed to its content, right? And at the end of the day, you know, if somebody on Reddit says that this company is worth something, and they quote somebody else from Reddit, you know, you might as well be talking about witchcraft. Or, you know, somebody says, oh, I know somebody who, you know, drank lemon juice and they didn't get COVID. You know, like, why would you, like,
yeah.
you see, when you hear people like that, you think they're crazy. So on the one hand, I think it's a positive sign that people are kind of interested in investments, but I also think it's kind of dangerous because people think that this is, you know, something that's easy, and that is, you know, ordinary people can kind of somehow access high quality information without doing work. And so that to me is the dangerous part about it. And what I worry is that it's the people who get burned, wind up losing all their money. They might give up on investing
right.
together, and you know, just say, that sucked. I saw the same thing happen in 1999. I know a lot of people that lost their shirt in the dot-com bubble, and then they just said, I'm not investing in the stock market anymore. And so what they do, they went and bought houses and then they lost all their money in their housing. Right. Yeah. And so, you know, yeah. And, you know, we're seeing this with, you know, with ARK, right. ARK has gone up and everybody's excited about it. Now it's back down. And, you know, whereas Berkshire Hathaway is just, you know, pumping along and you know, it's now ahead of where you know, ARK. So I think that it's kind of dangerous in a way. It's good that in a way it's something that people need to be very, very careful about. And I would encourage people to kind of do their research and figure out, you know, where the information is coming from. Now, that's not to say that these things don't move markets, because they clearly do, right? I mean, we look at what happened with AMC, we look at what happened with Reddit, you know, Tesla to some extent, and then, you know, a lot of the cryptos, a lot of the altcoins are you know, influenced by this. But at the end of the day, when you know, you can see somebody who's holding up a stack of bills on Reddit, or, you know, showing off their Lambo and something like that. But for every person like that, there's 10 that lost their shirts. Mm-hmm. And the institutional guys are laughing all the way to the bank, right? And so it's oftentimes the whole story was pitted as let's squeeze the shorts, let's go after the institutional folks. But hey, the institutional folks are the ones that make the money. My college roommate made $850 million in his fund on GameStop. And, you know, and I know most other people didn't. So there's when you go to the casino, you know, I don't know how well you're going to do, but I know how well the casino is going to do. It's going to do really well. And right. So I just say, think people have to be kind of just a little bit more, you know, wary, when they're delving into this game.
So I totally agree with you that it's dangerous, and, you know, I'd probably stay away from it, but does a part of you see any, does a part of you feel any way that, you know, like, this is dangerous, but it's the reality, so it's worth paying attention to at the same time?
Oh, yeah. I mean, of course, like, at the end of the day, I mean, forgetting about AMC and so forth, but, you know, thinking about crypto,
right?
You know, going back to the dot-com bubble, right? There was this massive bubble and then it burst. But what were we left with? Right. We were left with the internet. Right. And look at Amazon. I mean, Amazon is still there and it's doing great. And, you know, a lot of those companies that were created during that period, you know, went on to be extremely successful. And so, you know, crypto is not going to go away. Crypto is real. Right. And so, same thing happened when the bicycle was introduced, right? Back in the late 19th century, there was a massive run up in all these bicycle companies, and the bicycle stocks, and they went through the roof and they went up 10X, 20X, 30X. There was this thing called the bicycle bubble, and it all crashed and burned, right? But what we left with, we're left with the bicycle.
Mm-hmm.
The railroad bubble that happened in, you know, the early 19th century. And you know, the stock crashed about 95% after the bubble crashed, but hey, we were left with all these railroads. So, you know, crypto is real. It's going to be here. And I think to the extent that people are really in, you know, investing and learning about how it works and learning about the technology and learning about the governance mechanisms and, you know, learning about, you know, DeFi architecture and stuff, like, this is incredibly valuable. And I think it's really good that people are doing it. But when you buy something because you think it's going to double in value because, you know, your friend said it was going to, that's kind of a waste of your time. Like, just focus on, you know, learning what's real and what's not real. And of course you can do it. Like, I think there's plenty of money to be made, but just don't be under illusions that you're not, you know, you're gambling. Right? I mean, that's what it is.
Yeah. 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 So moving more into crypto, like, it's super interesting because, as many people have said, it's kind of the intersection between money and technology, mm-hmm. and also social trends, yeah. as well. But going forward, do you see potentially like, this being the generation where, you know, crypto becomes mainstream, where we might see it used more in, like, stores, you know, like real use cases rather mm-hmm. than just a nice idea?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, it will be mainstreamified for sure. There's lots of discussions of what we call central bank digital currencies. And so what that means is that, you know, the dollar is going to be digitized in ways that it isn't already. Of course, it's already, you know, quite digital, but there's going to be kind of transformations in the underlying architecture of how we move money around, how we move stocks around, you know, real estate, all sorts of things, right? You know, NFTs are real, and you know, it's a technology that isn't, goes beyond just laughing monkeys and so forth. So So I don't think there's any doubt. However, it's not gonna look that foreign at the end of the day. Like once it gets accepted and mainstreamified, it's no longer gonna be this alternative universe, you know, filled with eccentric people. It's just gonna be the way things, you know, get done. And you know, I like to say that when you go and you pour a glass full of water from the sink, you don't really know if it's a PVC pipe or a copper pipe. You don't really know if it's from a well or from a dam. You know, it's just water to you. And so, you know, when you go and pay for something at the store, you know, most people don't think about what's happening on the back end. They don't think, oh, well, you know, there's this payment system and these rails and, you know, and these, you know, these gateways and these networks and, you know, these banks and so forth. It's just, you know, it just works. And so I think a lot of the action is going to happen behind the scenes. And it's not going to be like I'm buying stuff with Bitcoin. I don't think Bitcoin's going to be a big transaction medium ever. But you know, we will be buying stuff using new kinds of payment technologies. And so, you know, getting up to speed on that, understanding how that works is going to be super beneficial for you as a, you know, potentially as a career opportunity.
I'm just wondering, like, what is that going to look like? Do you think, like, how mainstream will this go? Do you think, I have this question and a follow-up. So do you think I'll ever be walking home from school or work or whatever, and I'm not going to say Bitcoin, but, you know, pay for Starbucks with an alternative to the dollar?
You already do. Most people who go to Starbucks use their Starbucks app, right, to buy stuff. And you know, they're not paying with dollars. They're paying with Starbucks credits, right? Now, they bought the Starbucks credits with dollars at some point. Mm-hmm. But again, they didn't buy them with paper dollars. They bought it with probably their credit card, which is, you know, an imaginary representation of a dollar. So if you're thinking about kind of unit of account, like will the unit of account be different than a US dollar for most transactions? I don't think so. I think the US dollar will continue to be the unit of account for a number of reasons, not just because of legal tender laws, but also just because in most economies, we gravitate towards the single most liquid instrument, and that's the dollar. And we also are, you know, we don't like volatility, and we don't like to have to reprice things a lot. And so if you look at the volatility of Bitcoin, it's certainly reduced quite a bit over the last couple of years. I used to talk about it as being, you know, way more volatile than even the US stock market. But what we're finding now is its volatility is converging around the US stock market. But, you know, we don't go to buy a car with S&P 500s, and we don't go buy Starbucks with an S&P 500. We buy it with a US dollar because the US dollar has been historically, you know, very stable. And it's also something that is highly liquid. So, I don't think so. And even in countries like Venezuela, right, where the currency is completely useless, you know, people prefer to denominate things in dollars. I was in Argentina recently, and you know, everybody denominates everything in dollars, even when they're using pesos. They oftentimes quote it in dollars and then convert it to pesos. And there's a huge crypto ecosystem in Argentina. But even when people are moving kind of crypto around, they're denominating it in dollars, right? So I'm very skeptical that the dollar will be displaced as the central unit of account and medium of exchange. I think cryptocurrencies have potential value as a store value, right? So we think about gold. Gold is a very valuable kind of store value. People put money into gold and leave it there as a way of preserving, you know, their value, diversifying away from other securities. So, you know, that's one possible use case for cryptocurrencies. You know, other use cases for the technology have to do with, you know, moving things around. So for instance, if I, you know, buy a token, ship it to you, and then you sell the token, that can be in some cases, a more efficient way to move value across time and space compared to, you know, the mechanisms that we currently have. But that's still not using it as a transaction medium. It's kind of, you know, using it as it's, you're thinking of it as, you know, the technology for moving something else. So I think we have to be very careful about, you know, what we mean when we're talking about, you know, crypto. So for instance, you know, if an NFT is something you buy and then you buy it because it has, you know, scarcity value, and because it represents something else, right? But you're not like buying stuff with the NFT, you're buying the NFT, right? So it's just a little bit different. There have been all sorts of attempts to introduce alternative currencies in, you know, different communities and so forth. You know, if we think about airline miles are a form of alternative currency, and they're only useful for certain things, right? You use them for buying airline tickets and so forth, which is fantastic. You've got, you know, casino chips that you use in casinos, but these alternative currencies only typically work within these kind of closed ecosystem. And then the minute you leave that ecosystem, you want to convert it into something that has broader applications.
Mm-hmm. Talking about NFTs a little bit, do you have an opinion on them? Are they a fad? Are they here to stay?
I think they're here to stay. I don't think that, you know, it's the technology is here to stay, right? Because it's a technology that allows you to create something that is, you know, provably scarce, and it's difficult to replicate. Okay. And so it can be used, you know, for authentication and so forth. Now, usually I think the use case is going to not be for the NFT itself, but for, you know, the NFT is going to become the proof of something, the proof of authenticity or the proof of ownership or something. It's going to correspond to something outside of the crypto world, right? There's going to be some anchor out there to which it is, you know, a representation. So I don't think that technology is going to go anywhere. Now, do I think that if I was going to buy, you know, a Picasso or a bored monkey right now, I'd probably buy the Picasso because I think that some of these values are being inflated. But, you know, it's like crypto kitties. Remember a few years back, we had the crypto kitties and everybody was excited about crypto kitties. Now, this is the greatest thing in the world. And it actually clogged up the entire Ethereum network for a while because everybody was so excited about it. But, you know, crypto kitties are not that, you know, nobody buys crypto kitties anymore, but it was a great proof of concept of the, you know, underlying technology of Ethereum. And so we're now all living in a crypto kitty world, even though nobody buys crypto kitties.
Right. Do you see the only NFTs that have value, like as the ones that have real value outside of the blockchain? For example, like the Bored Apes, I know obviously, you know, you can use the picture to do whatever you want, but you know, there's also, it's also a form of status. I think get invited to a yacht party or something. It's very exclusive.
Yeah. Well, that's true of all art, right? I mean, it's true of all, you know, scarce items, rare items, right? You know, you create art, you create scarcity and potentially it means that people are going to, you know, want this, right? I mean, people buy, you know, paintings, people buy sculptures, people buy all sorts of things. You know, if you own, say, if you have a photograph and you put it on your wall, people say, oh, that's great. You know, like, yeah, it's original. Well, how do you know it's an original, right? I mean, somebody could take a photograph of a photograph and call it a photograph, right? And so, you know, with an NFT, you have some way of kind of proving that you are in fact the owner, which is important. And then if somebody has something that looks identical to it, you can prove that is, you know, a copy. And I think, you know, that's a super important technology. And everybody wants collectibles, everybody wants rare items. You know, but just because you made something using a particular medium doesn't mean that you're an artist necessarily, right? And so the value of the art may have to, you know, stand or fall independent of its scarcity, right? When you can make scarce things with ease, the world will be inundated with scarce things, and it doesn't mean that they're necessarily valuable.
Yeah, I kind of agree. I hate to keep prying about NFTs, but just to, you know, play devil's advocate a little bit. Mm-hmm. A part of me is kind of, you know, thinking about the future, like, okay, the proof of ownership aspect is huge, but how long do people care? Like, I know NBA Top Shot is a thing where you can technically own a specific highlight from basketball, but you know, that's cool for 2 weeks, but after that, like,
right,
who cares, you know?
Yeah, I mean, what does it mean? I mean, to say that you own it if somebody can, you know, watch it on YouTube, right? Yeah. I mean, like, so what? Yeah, no, you're absolutely right. I share your skepticism about these things. But, you know, on the other hand, look, Maurizio Catalan at Art Basel sold a banana taped to a wall, you know, for, I don't know,
that's what a good
it was. $150,000, right? So $150,000 for a banana taped to a wall. Now, what did you actually buy when you bought that? You didn't buy the banana, you know, because the banana is going to go rotten. So if you actually bought this, then it means that when you get back to your house, you can go grab a store-bought banana and some store-bought duct tape, and you can tape it up there. And then when it rots, you know, you can forget about it. And then when you got people coming over to your house for dinner, you get a new one and you tape it up there. And then you go, oh, there's my Catalan, right? So what you're actually buying for your $150,000, I can't remember the actual price is, you know, you buy like a certificate of, you know, authenticity, right, or whatever, right? You know, you buy some proof that you are indeed the person that bought the banana, right? Like,
yeah,
you're buying the right to exhibit it. Now look, there's nothing Maurizio Catalan can do. He can't sue me for copyright infringement if I tape a banana to my wall. But if I tape a banana to my wall and people come over to my house and I say that there's my Catalan, they're going to be like, no, it's not. You're not the one that bought it, right? Now, you could conceivably, all you'd have to do is, you know, look, Google, you know, who bought the Catalan, and you'd know. But what happens when you resell it? They're a record. So when I buy a house, right, my purchase of that house is actually recorded in a deed, which is located in a searchable database, right? Everyone knows where to go. And when someone claims that they're selling you a house or a car, you can actually go and find out if indeed it is your house or it is your car. We don't actually have anything similar for, you know, the world of art. We do have things similar for stocks and for bonds and other securities, although those systems are primitive in many ways. And so I think that, you know, the idea of having a database that is searchable and that is tamper-proof and that allows you to, you know, ascertain ownership, like, this is an extremely valuable thing. This is an incredible thing. And, you know, do I think that artwork is the most valuable application? Probably not, but, you know, for now, a lot of people are getting a lot of publicity for being, I'm the one that bought the $69 million. I don't think the guy who bought that $69 million NFT, I can't remember the name of it, I don't think that guy's ever going to be able to recoup even half of what he paid for it, right, going forward. But he's getting a lot of press out of it, so good for him.
Yeah, okay, yeah, I guess that makes sense, purely just, you know, status. Moving forward a little bit, just about crypto in general, I feel like I know what your response will be, but in your opinion, do you think crypto, this whole phenomenon, is, you know, society's reaction to political forces and, you know, global unrest, or is it really just a natural progression of, you know, us moving on to the next wave of technology?
I think it's both, right? I mean, I think new waves of technology happen. There's a hype cycle, right? And with crypto, we've seen hype cycle after hype cycle, right? And it keeps coming and going. But look, people want things to get excited about in the world of technology. And the thing is, this is the kind of technology that anybody can participate in. I'm not saying anybody can design a protocol, but anybody can buy crypto, right, with the push of a button. So you can actually, you know, be part of this kind of revolution with you know, with the click of a mouse or, you know, push of a thumb. So I think that's one thing. But I think there is this underlying dissatisfaction with a lot of aspects of how the world is organized. And indeed, if you go back to, you know, Satoshi Nakamoto's original, you know, white paper, I think that, you know, there is an underlying distrust of financial institutions, underlying distrust of political institutions. And there's a deep history behind that. You know, when Friedrich Hayek wrote a book on, you know, private currencies, it was during the inflationary times, you know, stagflation times. And, you know, we may be heading back to stagflation times. And I think I mentioned Argentina and Venezuela and, you know, US will probably not achieve those kind of inflation levels, but, you know, we're entering into a period where there's, you know, there's a lot of anxiety and the anxiety preceded COVID, carried on through COVID, and it's going to continue after COVID. And so people are, and I'm not saying it's people are looking for something safe and secure, because this is not safe and secure, but they're looking for something where, you know, they can find trust in other places. And even though this is a technology that allows for decentralized trust in a very powerful way, you know, most of these things you shouldn't trust.
Right. Right.
There's a lot of scams out there. Just saying.
Definitely. So how can, you know, how do you think the crypto experiment can go wrong if you think it can? Like, is there anything that, you know, kind of keeps you up at night or is stressing you out subconsciously about it?
Yeah. I mean, what worries me is that, you know, like I have a friend and she, you know, she's a PhD student and she doesn't, you know, make a whole heck of a lot of money. And, you know, she had like $600 in savings to her name, right? That's it. And she was, you know, eating, you know, oatmeal for dinner, right? And so she put all her $600 into crypto. Right.
Right.
And, you know, that's the kind of thing that worries me. Right. Now, granted, $600 is not a lot to lose, but it's pretty much everything, right, for her. So, so I think a lot of people are, you know, potentially in that scenario where they're kind of thinking get rich quick. So I do worry about that. But you know, that's not just true with crypto. That's true with penny stocks. That's true with, you know, AMC. Yeah. That's true with all sorts of things, right? Mm-hmm. Casinos, lottery tickets. There's lots of stuff like that. But you know, other than that, like, I'm not particularly worried. I don't think that there's any potential source of systemic risk here. You know, we just saw Bitcoin lose, you know, half of its value. Didn't lead to a global financial crisis, right? So if I'm going to worry about the next global financial crisis, I don't think it's going to come from crypto. So I say, you know, carry on. We may need maybe some investor protections. We've seen how, you know, Floyd Mayweather and DJ Khaled, they, you know, they got smacked down for endorsing, you know, tokens that right. were characterized as securities. You know, I don't think there weren't too many people's lives who were ruined by that. So I don't think it's that big of a deal. So I don't really lose any sleep at all over the crypto world.
Okay. Do you think here, just, we don't have much time left, so I just wanted to get your take on this. Just top five things you'd want kids to know about crypto just going forward or to keep in mind?
Okay. It's not going to replace money in the way that people think it will. Okay. There's no surefire way to get rich quick in the world of crypto. So those are my cautionary things. On the other hand, this is a fascinating new field of technology. I think it's worth learning about and it's worth studying, and it can be used as a launch point for understanding so much about finance. I used to teach a course on money and banking, and I'd talk a lot about the history of money and what is money and, you know, what are banks and what are financial institutions and how do markets work. And, you know, students used to, some students were interested, but most students were like, yeah, whatever, whatever. Once crypto came on the scene, now all of a sudden everybody's interested. They're like, wait, what is money? And wait, what happens when I put my, when I go to Coinbase and, you know, give them my private key? Like, how is that like a bank, right? Or wait, there's no deposit insurance. What's deposit insurance? So I think that what crypto has done is it's stimulated interest in money, in finance, in investments. And so even if people kind of lose interest in crypto after a while, the residue that's left behind, as long as you didn't lose your shirt and, you know, you decide to stay away from investments forever, that's the risky run. But if that doesn't happen, then the residue that's left behind is a deep curiosity about technology, about finance, about databases, which will ultimately, you know, lead to more curiosity about other things that'll help you navigate a world of rapid technological change.
Yeah. Wow. I mean, it's a super interesting way to think about it.
Yeah. So yeah, hopefully that's helpful. And hopefully, you know, people will be, you know, interested without, you know, being crazy in their enthusiasm, yeah, totally. You know, moderation in all things, right, Alex?
For sure. Yeah. That's definitely how I think about it too. So I think that's all the time we have. So Professor LeBlanc, thank you so much for coming on the Crypto Rabbit Hole. This is super interesting. Just lastly, how can people find out more about you if they want to?
You can just Google me. I have a couple talks up on YouTube. I have one on FinTech where I talk a little bit about crypto and blockchain. But yeah, and then, you know, LinkedIn, I've got some other things.
Yeah. Updates. Awesome.
And I have a podcast. My podcast is called Unsiloed Podcast. And you know, I interview people on finance and business strategy, psychology, and all sorts of other things.
Yeah, definitely. So I definitely encourage everyone watching to check that out. And thank you so much for coming.
Okay. See you later.